Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, January 17th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital at its pain management program. Led by Dr. Gordon Kuhar, treating conditions including arthritis, back, neck, and cancer pain, peripheral neuropathy, and fibromyalgia. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. He is here to discuss gynecological oncology. And if you have a question, get in early. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Dr. Benjamin Margolis, we will meet the doctor coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here on this Medical Monday is Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. Dr. Benjamin Margolis is a gynecologic oncologist at Albany Med who specializes in the medical and surgical management of ovarian, uterine, cervical, and other gynecological cancers. He also treats patients of all ages with pre-invasive conditions and complex gynecologic diseases that require surgery. He completed a fellowship in gynecologic oncology at New York University Langone Health and a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia, both in New York City. He earned his medical degree from Yale. To be a part of today's conversation, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Margolis, welcome to Vox Pop.
Thank you. So happy to be on the show.
Great to have you here. Let's, before we get into treatments and prevention, let's talk about the basic types of gynecologic cancer.
Sure. So when talking about gynecologic cancer, it's broken down into five basic types. There's the ovary and the fallopian tube, which we usually think of together. There's the cervix, the uterus, the vagina, and the vulva. The last two are the more rare types.
What is the most common type?
The most common type of gynecologic cancer is uterine cancer. It's actually the number five most common type of cancer of any cancer in the United States.
We have heard about hysterectomies for a long time, so I assume that uterine cancer is one of the most, it has the best outcomes of many of the cancers.
Yeah, you know, there's a wide array of uterine cancers under that big umbrella. So the most common type of uterine cancers are generally diagnosed at early stages. The nicer thing about them is that they present with bleeding, and so there's an early warning sign. And when caught early, most uterine cancers are successfully treated with surgery. Sometimes they require chemotherapy and radiation afterwards or a combined modality to treatment. There are other types of uterine cancer that can progress at later or show up at later stages and are a little bit more difficult to treat.
The number to call here, by the way, is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. Ovarian cancer is one that is scares many people, and it's the very name will strike terror into many. How are the outcomes now over, say, 20 years ago?
Yeah, you know, ovarian cancer, so while uterine cancer is in the top 10 in terms of the most common cancers, ovarian cancer is in the top 10 when it comes to the most common causes of cancer-related death. And so traditionally, ovarian cancer is thought of as a very difficult-to-treat disease. You know, with time, there's been many new treatments that turn ovarian cancer for many folks into a little bit more of a chronic disease where people cycle through different treatment options over a long period of time. That's also a very heterogeneous bag. You know, some people are diagnosed with early stages of ovarian cancer or more rare types that actually have a very good outcome. And then you kind of have the most common type of ovarian cancer, what people traditionally think of, and that is generally discovered at later stages and is difficult to diagnose, and so the outcomes are not quite as good.
Why is it difficult to diagnose early in some cases.
Yeah. So, you know, the ovaries and the organs of the pelvis are sitting in the abdomen. And I usually use the analogy of if you took a beach ball and you kind of threw a bunch of things inside and then you deflated it. So there's a bunch of room inside that beach ball for things to grow and for things to metastasize. And so oftentimes there's a period of time where things are growing and there's just no associated symptoms because there's a lot of room inside the abdomen. And by the time that people develop symptoms, it can be a later stage of presentation. So the symptoms to watch out for are weight loss, early, feeling like you can't finish a meal early, kind of vague, crampy abdominal pain and bloating.
Who is most at risk to develop a gynecologic cancer? In other words, is heredity a part of the equation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the more common types of gynecologic malignancies we typically associate with hereditary conditions are ovarian and fallopian tube cancer. Those are most commonly seen in patients that have BRCA mutations. Those are familial mutations. There's a number of less commonly known ones that are also familial and increase the risk of ovarian and fallopian tube cancer. There's another type of condition called Lynch syndrome that can place people at risk for colon cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, and a number of less common ones. So heredity plays a large role.
What are some of the other risk factors?
So age is generally the biggest risk factor for a lot of GYN malignancies, particularly uterine and ovarian cancer. And then when you go into cervical cancer, that kind of is a very different discussion that then has to do with HPV, which I'm sure we'll end up talking about over the course of the show. But that's a virus that leads to cancerous changes, and that really is not related to genetics. And so for cervical cancer, one of the biggest risk factors is the persistent presence of an HPV infection, which is very common among sexually active people. So it's almost ubiquitous. Anyone who's sexually active has seen HPV in their lifetime, and a certain percentage of those people are going to have that virus hang around for a long time, and that's what then places them at risk for cervical cancer.
Now, that's a very interesting answer. Why is it that some people are not affected by it, and some people have that HPV virus hang around forever?
Yeah, the easy answer is we don't know. So about 80% of people will end up clearing the virus completely with no lasting effects. And for that 10 to 20% of people that don't, some of them, it will create what we call low-grade changes where the cells look mildly abnormal and won't really progress to cancer. And in a certain percentage of them, they will create high-grade changes. And so the most important thing to focus on, because we haven't quite gotten to why some people clear it and other people don't, is what's called cervical cancer screening. So being on top of looking for those early changes, treating those early changes, and assuring that you have appropriate follow-up so that we prevent cancer in the future. And we're pretty successful at that when people are seeing their physician.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. Dr. Margolis is a gynecologic oncologist at Albany Med. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And before we get to the calls and the emails, doctor, let's go back to HPV for a moment. Vaccines have been quite a topic over the last couple of years here in this country and around the world. There has always been some controversy lingering with the HPV vaccine. Give us what you know.
Yeah. So, you know, the HPV vaccine is a great one because it actually has a very large body of safety evidence, high quality medical evidence that shows that there is really no medical concern with receiving the HPV vaccine. And right on top with that is just how effective it is. So you have a vaccine, the HPV vaccine, that is incredibly safe as far as all medical reports out there report on, and you also have upwards of 97 to 98% effectiveness of the HPV vaccine in preventing cervical cancer. And so those two things combined really provide a strong rationale for universal administration of the HPV vaccine. You know, in countries that have had really good adoption of the HPV vaccine, decades later, we're now seeing the cervical cancer incidence fall. So to see that work actually happening has been unbelievable.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis joins us today. I want to talk to you about treatment options and new technologies, but we'll do that on the other side of the break, and we'll get some calls in as well. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, it's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med joins us to talk gynecologic oncology on the program today. And the number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And we will get to the email bag shortly. Let's go to the phones. Susie in Brattleboro, Vermont. Susie, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm age 76, and I just wondered whether preventative tests like the pap smear and any other to prevent cervical cancer and other cancers, do you recommend that for a 76-year-old?
That's a really great question. So it depends on whether or not you've had abnormal pap smears in the past. In general, if someone has not had abnormal pap smears in the past or has 20 years without them, we recommend discontinuing or stopping cervical cancer screening at age 65. So if there were abnormal pap smears in your near past, it could be important to continue them. What's really important is to have a yearly relationship with a GYN provider so that they can size up those risks and make the appropriate recommendations.
Thank you.
Susie, thanks for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Jill in Newburgh writes, I had a total hysterectomy in 2006 for stage 1A uterine carcinoma at the age of 55. There was no follow-up treatment, but I did undergo a bilateral mastectomy 2 years later. I have tested negative for BRCA. Should I be undergoing periodic screening for recurrence, especially if I am having any pelvic discomfort? And two, should I be avoiding any and all phytoestrogens?
So generally, you know, following up after having a gynecologic malignancy is very important. So we usually recommend something we call surveillance, which is this active period of time where patients are seeing their provider frequently, reporting any symptoms and undergoing physical exams. And so for an early stage uterine cancer that we just heard about, the recommendation would be to follow up every 6 months for 2 years and then every year afterwards. Sometimes after 5 years, you know, gynecologic oncologists recommend transitioning that care back to a gynecologist who feels comfortable with exams for people who've had cancer before. But absolutely, any new symptoms like vaginal bleeding, pelvic discomfort, discharge, those are things that should be reported to a provider, either a general gynecologist or the oncologist that performed the surgery.
Now, in Jill's email, there are a couple of terms you got to define for me. What is a BRCA?
So BRCA mutations are the most common type of hereditary, what we call breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. They're a chromosomal mutation passed down from generation to generation, and they put patients at higher risk for both breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Those are the large, you know, risks, and there are a number of smaller cancer risks.
Jill also wrote about phytoestrogens? I have no idea what they are. What is that?
Yeah, so phytoestrogens are a sort of plant substances that are biologically similar to estrogens that are found inside the body. For her type of cancer, you know, a distant history of an early stage uterine cancer, that would not necessarily be a reason to avoid phytoestrogens. But the most important thing is that a lot of those supplements that kind of make claims, it would be important to know why, you know, she's asking and, you know, for what reason she was considering taking phytoestrogens. But a lot of the supplements that are marketed as, you know, possibly increasing estrogen levels in patients who, you know, feel symptoms of menopause, those statements and those products are often not evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration and don't undergo the same quality standards as prescribed medications by a physician would. So I think if there are concerns about menopausal symptoms, particularly, that it's best to talk to a doctor about those.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Back to the phones, Janet in Williamstown. Janet, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, probably about 15 years ago, with a routine pap smear, I was diagnosed as having precancerous cells. Originally, they had to go and do a cone procedure just to be sure, and it came back as though the physician recommended a hysterectomy. I went ahead and did the hysterectomy. I've had no symptoms or no signs of any cancerous diagnosis. However, I was also advised to continue to do pap smears. So I guess my question is twofold. First of all, was it wise to go ahead and get the hysterectomy right away? And also, would I have to get a pap smear after having a hysterectomy?
Those are really great questions. So, you know, it's a little bit hard to comment without knowing the details of the pathology. There certainly are situations in which you can see concerning cells on a pap smear or on a cone that would make a provider recommend a hysterectomy. So I do think that treatment is appropriate, you know, in certain situations, and I would assume that it was in yours. And it is important to continue pap smear screening afterwards because the HPV virus that causes those abnormal cells, you know, there's no line in the sand that it, you know, sees some cells in the back of the vagina but not others. And so there's no clear border between the edge of the cervix and the top of the vagina. And so we assume that if the virus has infected the cervical cells and is causing abnormal changes there, that virus is also present at the back of the vagina. There's much lower risk that the virus causes, let's say, a new cancer at the back of the vagina after the uterus and the cervix are removed. So that's why some people sometimes recommend a hysterectomy to remove the cervix. But there can be still changes that are precancerous in the back of the vagina, and it is very important to still follow up and keep an eye on them because very rarely those changes can approach, you know, very abnormal-looking changes and very, very rarely turn to cancer at the back of the vagina.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Janet, thanks a lot for the call. We are joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. How common is it for a virus to be the primary cause of cancer?
So for GYN cancers and for head and neck cancers, there's a large body of evidence that really show that there are multiple different strains of the HPV virus that account for a large number of those cancers. So for cervical cancer, we actually believe upwards of 90%+ are attributable to HPV, which is why the vaccine is so important in preventing cancer. There's a very, very small percentage of cervical cancers that really have nothing to do with HPV, that are difficult to detect on pap smears, and that are not impacted by the HPV vaccine.
Let's go back to the phones with Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Medical Center. 800-348-2551 is the number. Jim is in Matamoros. Jim.
Oh, did I lose you? I'm not here.
No, you're still there, but we don't hear Jim. Jim, are you there? Jim. Jim is not there. All right, Jim, you had your chance, and thank you very much. Our number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Let's talk about types of treatment. There are the standard types of treatment we hear about.
Not sure if there was a connection issue.
Can you hear me now? Hello? Apparently, we have lost the doctor, so let's try it again. Tell you what, Zach, why don't you play some incidental music, and we'll figure this one out. Are you there, doctor? Okay. All right, we'll be right back here on Vox Pop Medical Monday. And once again, the number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the program, 2:30 on a Monday afternoon. It is Medical Monday, and we're joined today by gynecologic oncologist Dr. Benjamin Margolis. You see, Dr. Margolis, ordinarily we have live guests in the studio. Occasionally during the pandemic, we have locked down. And when I say occasionally, it was like 18 months. We only reopened a couple of months ago. We're back to lockdown. I hope you can, and sometimes the phones just drop. It's the way it goes.
Yeah. But it looks like I lost you, but now I'm back.
Okay, that's very good. And so we talked a little bit about viruses and them being a primary cause of some types of cancer. And what are some of the, we talked about the risk factors and heredity. What are some of the behavioral factors that can cause trouble in your line of work?
You know, there's not really much we talk about other than smoking. I mean, smoking, I would say, is one of the biggest risk factors for both uterine cancer and for cervical cancer. The changes that happen with cigarette use make the body more susceptible to the impact of HPV, and smoking is also a known risk factor for uterine cancer. But those that is really the big one that is a modifiable one. Oh, I would also have to say that weight control is an impact when it comes to uterine cancer. So one of the things that it can cause uterine cancer is an excess of estrogen in the body. And so estrogen can cause changes in the lining of the uterus that can cause it to look more atypical. And if there's an excess of estrogen, can kind of keep it growing in what can become an abnormal way that ultimately could turn to cancer. And so when someone's weight is very high, the adipose tissue or the fat tissue can actually convert some of the chemicals in your body into estrogens. And so that's one mechanism by which you can have an excess of estrogen that can cause trouble with regards to uterine cancer.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis. Before you lost connection, I was talking about the types of treatment, and I understand this, the standard types of treatment, surgery and chemo and radiation. And I wondered about, first of all, surgery. Are micro robotics now being used more in your specialty?
You know, robotic surgery has been around since, you know, commonly since like the early 2000s. You know, it gained a lot of traction for a number of reasons. There's really great visualization with the robotic platform. The robot is essentially a way to perform laparoscopic surgery with really good visualization and with a wristedness to your hand. So traditionally with laparoscopy, which is the small incisions and camera to do surgery, you're just a little bit limited in your dexterity inside the abdomen. You know, now some people are fantastic surgeons and are able to navigate that limitation, you know, really beautifully. And other people, you know, or in general, it just can help out to have a little bit more dexterity on the inside. And so the robotic platform assists with that. And, it makes a lot of things possible that I would say once were not. So in gynecologic oncology, you know, we use it commonly for surgeries for ovarian masses. We use it for uterine cancer surgeries. We use it for difficult hysterectomies and a wide variety of other surgeries. Now, you know, like any medical device, medical devices are sometimes just kind of widely adopted into practice, you know, without the sort of study that sometimes they could. So
really?
Recently they're studied for safety, but sometimes, you know, using a new technology to perform a surgery is not necessarily always going to be associated with better outcomes. This doesn't necessarily apply to the robot itself, but we were surprised recently in our field when in 2018 there were the results of a study which randomized patients to, you know, getting a laparoscopic procedure or an open procedure for cervical cancer, for early stage cervical cancer. This is less about the robot and more just about laparoscopy, but we were all surprised to learn that, the folks who had a minimally invasive procedure seemed to not do as well in terms of their survival compared to the ones who had, you know, a traditional larger incision.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Margolis is a gynecologic oncologist. Whenever I have an oncologist on, I'm fascinated specifically about radiation and how it has been used with more precision than ever before. Is this helping what you do and the outcomes of your patients?
Yeah, so I'd say the one gynecologic malignancy that we use radiation as the cornerstone of treatment is cervical cancer. So early stage cervical cancer, you know, can be treated with either surgery or radiation and chemotherapy. But the more advanced stages of cervical cancer are usually treated with a combination of chemotherapy and surgery. And traditionally, you know, radiation was given pretty imprecise methods, you know. It was given to the target tissue, but it also hit a lot of the surrounding tissue,
right,
and caused a lot of toxicity. And in the area where we're treating a cervical cancer, the two things that are right next to that are the bladder and the bowel. And so over time, there's been an incredible advance in the technology that's allowed radiation oncologists to target just the important tissue and really minimize the side effects of radiation to the surrounding tissues. The radiation oncologists are really the experts in that field, but that's something called intensity modulated radiation therapy, or IMRT. And it's really revolutionized the side effect profile of the radiation that we often recommend patients get.
Let's jump back on the phone here before our next break. We'll go to Patricia, who is in Worcester. Patricia, you're on. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a granddaughter.
Patricia, hang on just a sec. Can you turn off your speakerphone and maybe turn the radio down just a little bit?
Okay, just a minute.
Thank you. It'll just take a moment. We often hear ourselves back through the phones, and we sound great, but it makes it a little confusing. Are you there, Patricia?
Okay,
go ahead.
Yes. Well, I have a granddaughter that has cervical cancer, or uterine. I don't know. My daughter doesn't tell me all the facts, but it's stage four, and I was wondering.
Yes.
Well, you know what I was wondering. You answered some of the questions because she doesn't smoke. She is overweight. And I was wondering why the doctors didn't pick up on this before it got to stage four.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis.
Yeah, you know, it can be difficult to understand exactly why some people present at later stages. You know, sometimes people can kind of hold off on seeing the doctor when they have symptoms. Other times the symptoms can be mild, or, you know, someone can think that they're normal, depending on how old, you know, she is. There are certain symptoms that overlap with both.
She's in her 30s.
In her 30s, yeah. So, you know, there are symptoms that could overlap with things that are commonly seen, you know, like a little bit of spotting after sex, or, you know, what can be seen as an irregular period or a pelvic pain that, you know, a lot of women of reproductive age could experience at certain times in their life. And so it is not uncommon to see things present late, and it's unfortunate when that happens.
Okay, Patricia?
Go
ahead.
I know that she's taking chemo. She went to a chemo and a radiation thing. Right now it's just chemo.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult, you know, without knowing whether it's a cervical cancer or a uterine cancer. Given her age, I would consider that it's probably more likely a cervical cancer. And generally at stage four, you know, we would treat that with radiation and with chemotherapy. You know, for what's called locally advanced cervical cancer, you can actually have stage four disease and still have a good chance at cure. And with most cervical cancer, unless there are what's called distant, you know, metastases or distant disease, we aim for curative intent treatment. And so, you know, hopefully that's the situation she's in. So it's one of those cancers that even later stages still have a good chance at achieving a long-term remission.
What about if it's uterine? I never get a direct answer when I ask my daughter about it. I don't ask my granddaughter about it, but
it is difficult to comment without knowing all the details, because even stage four cancer represents a grab bag of things. You know, stage four cancer could mean cancer that's spread to many different places in the body, or for the case of uterine cancer, it could mean cancer that's just touching one of the structures next to the uterus. And so those two situations would be much different, and they would both carry a different weight. So it is hard to say.
Patricia, thank you very much for the call. We're overdue for a break here. We're joined by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. And the number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And we're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis, a gynecologic oncologist at Albany Med. This email from Deborah, who writes, 5 years ago, I lost a dear friend to a rare uterine cancer called, and I'll try to pronounce this right, doctor, leiomyosarcoma. Have there been any breakthroughs in treating this?
Leiomyosarcoma is a rare type of uterine cancer, and it can be tricky to treat. There are no breaking new developments that I know of, but it is one of those cancers that, again, is hard to pick up. This one doesn't necessarily come with an early warning sign of vaginal bleeding. And the tricky part about a leiomyosarcoma is that even at the early stages, even when it's still just confined to the uterus and caught at stage one, it has a tendency to spread early through the bloodstream and through the lymph nodes. And so it's one of those ones where even with the best of treatments, there is a decent chance that the cancer could come back, even if everything is done perfectly. Now, if cancer has come back, you know, there are new treatment options, I'd say, over the last, you know, 5 or so years. There's an interesting treatment option that comes from a sea cucumber. But, you know, all of these treatments generally do a good job at controlling disease for a short amount of time, but we haven't found that magic treatment option that's going to really control it for a long period of time.
Are you optimistic that you will find such a treatment?
It's difficult. You know, the science is running at such a fast pace, and I would say that for certain certain gynecologic cancers, things like uterine cancer, things like ovarian cancer, I think we've seen a lot of really promising treatments in the past, you know, 5 or so years, things like immunotherapy and some specific treatments called PARP inhibitors, which kind of go hand in hand with those BRCA mutations and work very, very well. You know, for leiomyosarcoma, it's one of the ones that has stayed a little bit in the dark ages. And even though there are some new treatments, we haven't seen the kind of progress that I would have hoped for.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. The number is 800-348-2551. And I believe right before your phone line dropped, Jim in Matamoros, his phone line also dropped. Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
Yeah. How engorged can an abdomen become due to a cystic ovary?
The answer to that question could surprise you, because I have seen ovaries that, are the size of, you know, a pumpkin that could win a state fair. So the size of the abdominal wall and the abdominal cavity is pretty big. And there are certain times where we've seen ovarian cysts present in patients who are older, in their 60s, who look like they're pregnant. So they can become quite large. But that doesn't always mean that there's a cancer going on. Actually, usually when a singular ovarian mass gets that large, it's usually something other than a cancer, something called a borderline tumor or just a benign cyst. Do you have experience with someone you know who had a large tumor?
A cousin and also a classmate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can cause a lot of symptoms. And so the nice thing about those is that usually when we take them out, people feel a whole lot better. And I'd say the vast majority of time, they don't end up being a cancer.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. This borderline of which you speak is interesting to me. At what point do you cross over into becoming cancer?
Yeah, so there's a whole host of different pathologic definitions. So when a pathologist looks at an ovarian tumor under the microscope, they look at a couple of different things. They look at how abnormal the middle of the cell looks. They look at how rapidly the cells are dividing. And then they look at the architecture. They look at the way the cells are growing. And so there's actually a pretty complicated classification system where there's a spectrum of abnormalities that all range from, completely benign. There's something called borderline, where the cells look abnormal and they're growing in an abnormal way. And then there are certain features that then push that over the line to become a cancer. And so one of the defining features is when those cells break through what's called the basement membrane. So the lining that separates the cyst from the rest of the ovary. And so if the abnormal cells are growing past that lining into the normal ovary, that's when something becomes considered a cancer.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis, a gynecologic oncologist at Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551. Barbara's in Sunderland, Vermont. Barbara, you're on.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I was interested in why uterine cancer is so difficult to diagnose, because when you go to your doctor all the time and you have pap smears, et cetera, I assume that you're saying that pap smears do not catch uterine cancer. Is that correct?
Sometimes, actually, uterine cancer cells can be detected on a pap smear, and some patients do present that way. You know, I would say that as a blanket statement, among the GYN cancers, uterine cancers are among the easier ones to diagnose because, they exist inside the uterus that has this kind of outflow tract to the cervix and the vagina, and so a common way that they present is with vaginal bleeding. And, one of the important things for anyone to know is that after menopause, if they have any vaginal bleeding, that is a reason to call your doctor. It's a reason to be seen because that's not a normal finding, and that requires some workup and thought into why that's happening. And so they usually are actually caught in the earlier stages.
Thank you. And just one other thing. So bleeding, that's right. You said that bleeding was the symptom that you should pay attention if you're postmenopausal. I had a personal experience with this where I was not postmenopausal, but I was bleeding. And I went to a specialist who I did not know, and she saw that I hadn't had a pap smear in a year or two. And she says, well, this is probably uterine cancer. This is very serious, might be uterine cancer. Why didn't you get a pap smear? And then when she came back, she says, well, I have bad news and good news. The bad news is that you're pregnant. The good news is that you don't have uterine cancer.
Oh, boy. Yeah, so, you know, we keep a lot of things in mind. So before menopause, if your bleeding pattern changes, it can be due to a whole host of reasons. It could be due to cancer. It could be due to a precancerous thing. It could be due to pregnancy. Or it could be due to fibroids or polyps. Or what we call the list of things is very, very long. And, you know, another important thing that you mentioned there is that, you know, it's actually not necessary to get pap smears every 1 to 2 years. So if you're seeing your GYN doctor, the frequency with which people should be getting pap smears is actually on the 3 to 5 year timeline if they're normal. And so there's two different ways to do a pap smear, and depending on which way they're done, it's usually a 3 to 5 year interval.
Are you saying that pap smears can do some damage?
You know, I don't think they can do damage, but sometimes they can cause concern, you know, and sometimes if they're done more frequently than is necessary, you have an increased risk of picking up something that could cause alarm or lead to a biopsy that otherwise might not. So I think if things are normal,
What do you mean picking something up, doctor? What do you mean?
Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara.
Yeah, so a pap smear looks at just individual cells that are kind of sloughed off, that are kind of scraped off from the cervix. And so those cells can look abnormal for a variety of reasons. They could be there can be some inflammation. There could be a surrounding infection that the body is reacting to that makes those cells look abnormal. And so, you know, we recommend pap smears at an interval that's based on our prediction of how long it takes for the HPV virus to turn abnormal cells into cancer. So at a point in time, if you've had a normal pap smear, there's a prediction model that looks at how far in the future do we think you could go without looking at this again, and what's the chance that you would develop an abnormality. The nice thing about the HPV virus and the changes that it causes in the cells is that they usually happen very slowly over the course of 3 to 7 years for something to become cancerous. So that's where that 3 to 5 year time frame comes in.
And you're comfortable with that interval?
Oh, yeah. Those are the recommended guidelines by the American Cancer Society, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. That is what all obstetricians and gynecologists, you know, should be following. Now, there, of course, are exceptions to the rule. There's certain clinical reasons why one could consider deviating from guidelines. So it's not to say that, you know, thou shalt never get a pap smear, you know, less than 3 years. But if everything's going normally and routine and you haven't had abnormal ones recently, then that should be the general guidelines. Now, of course, that goes completely out the window if you're following an abnormal pap smear, because then things space really close together once you have those abnormal changes.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. Mary in Greenwich writes, "It was found that I have an ovarian cyst during an ultrasound. Went back for repeat ultrasound 3 months later. It was still present, and they discovered it had tissue in it. My doctor did blood work, tumor markers, which came back within normal range. Will I need to continue to get that monitored, or will more testing be required to be sure it's just a cyst? Where should I go from here?" And that's from Mary in Greenwich.
Mary, that's a great question. I don't suppose you included your age on your email address.
Mary did not do that, no.
So, yeah, you know, that's a difficult question to answer. You know, the important thing there is that a GYN or a GYN oncologist should take a look at the images, take a look at the full picture. There are definitely some ovarian masses that, if they're proved to be stable over time, can be either watched or actually forgotten about completely if they look benign appearing, they look non-cancerous, and they're not growing. Usually in people who are past the age of menopause, when we have a cyst that's kind of indeterminate, you know, it doesn't look completely benign, even if we don't really think it's a cancer, we generally recommend removing those types of ovarian cysts. But again, depending on the age and the way things look, there's a wide variety of recommendations.
This email from Mark, and Mark writes, "You mentioned that high levels of estrogen can contribute to cancers within the body. There seems to be more and more information coming out about the dangers of endocrine disruptors, that many products such as soy can interfere with the body's hormone balance. Do you recommend that women avoid having too much soy in their diets? And how do you feel about endocrine disruptors in general?" And that's from Mark.
I don't generally recommend avoiding soy products or other dietary things that could, you know, have estrogen in them. I think eating a varied and normal diet is something that's important, as along with, you know, maintaining exercise. I'm not exactly sure of that term, endocrine disruptor, but there are a whole host of, you know, supplements out there that have either something called bioidentical estrogens, or like the phytoestrogens we talked about, or some of the precursors of estrogen that kind of make a wide array of claims of medical benefits. Those I would generally stay away from. But diet, I think, you know, eat what seems healthy and appealing.
Doctor, we're almost done here. We only have a couple of minutes, but let's talk about the future. You know, you've been in this business for a long time, and your CV is impressive, but you still seem like a fairly young person, and you'll be in this a while. Where do you see gynecologic oncology going in the next 10 and the next 20 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you'd get different answers based on who you talk to.
Yeah.
You know, I believe in personalized medicine. I'm very hopeful about I think the phase we're in right now in terms of GYN oncology is kind of data collection. You know, looking at the genomic sequences and the DNA of people's tumors is something that's only been, you know, kind of widely available for maybe 10 or so years.
Yeah.
And so there's this whole body of genetic information that we're sorting our way through. We're trying to reclassify gynecologic cancer, as we've already started to do it with uterine cancer. Whole other hour-long discussion. We're taking those traditional subtypes and redefining them and coming up with four new ones. And so it's only a matter of time until within each of these genetic subtypes of the different types of cancers, we can then match which are the right treatments. We can match which are the ones we've accidentally been given too much treatment for, which are the ones that our standard treatments are the best for. And then there's a whole host of new scientific discoveries and treatments, things like immunotherapy, things like targeted therapy, working on targeting the specific genetic abnormalities to certain tumors. And so we're in like the infancy of turning those discoveries into real clinical successes. There have been small wins when it comes to those things in gynecologic cancer, some in ovarian cancer, some in uterine cancer, some across different cancers, that actually now the site of cancer doesn't even matter anymore, because as long as you have that mutation, then this treatment goes with it. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that. But I do think, you know, we're at the beginning of that revolution.
So you think genetic therapy and the like could be the key to all of this?
You know, I give caution with oversimplifying. You know, if you take an analogy, once a cancer has been detected and once there's a physical tumor present, you're talking about trillions of cells that have had time to mutate, that have had time to become kind of its own city. And in the city, there's people of different types. There's all sorts of different cells that have had time to adapt, you know. So it really, the reason cancer can be so difficult to treat is that, you know, using one term, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, it doesn't get at just how much complexity, like genetic complexity, there is within just one person's cancer. And so that's why even looking at the genetics, you know, is difficult. I'm hopeful that, you know, cancers will become more and more manageable. But I caution sweeping statements about cancers just, you know, completely being eradicated because of that.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis, we are out of time. I appreciate you working through the technical glitches today. And we'll hopefully,
thank you so much.
Hopefully you come back. We'll have you in person. Thanks again for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Support comes from Upstate Dermatology, providing medical and surgical dermatology services for more than 30 years in the Capital Region, with offices in Clifton Park, Schenectady, Cobleskill, Skodak, and Chatham. UpstateDerm.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Benjamin Margolis for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our intrepid engineer, and Jada Lewis, who fought through all the technical glitches as well to screen the calls. Thanks, Jada. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Physical Therapy with Matthew Goodemote. Always comes in handy after you've been shoveling, which a lot of us have been doing. Stand by now for the Media Project.